Some of the most necessary and important things around us are so common that we stop even seeing them or thinking much about them often. But when it comes to something as vital as soil, really need to take the time to pay attention and keep it healthy. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're going to spend some time talking about soil. What is soil? What makes it healthy? What makes it unhealthy? Alexander Barton is Director of Business Development for the Agronomic Science Foundation and for the Alliance of Crop, Soil, and Environmental Science Societies. He's also a former student in the Department of Life Sciences Communication, where I hang my hat from time to time. So, Alexander, it's great to have you here.
It's very good to see you, too, again, Larry.
Yeah, it's great to see you. Also with us today, Jimmy Bramblett, who is a state conservationist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture Natural Resources Conservation Service. And, Jimmy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have both of you here. And, you know, we kind of forget, I think, sometimes about how important soil really is. And you think about, what's world population? World population going to increase, going from 7 to 9 billion or something like that?
That's right, even more in the next 50 years.
Yeah, so to sustain that level of growth, we're going to need a huge increase in food production, I would think.
That's
Jimmy?
Exactly right. Estimates are that we need to increase food production by 70% between now and 2050. And when you think about a 2 billion person population increase, well, that's only 20-some-odd percent. So why 70%? Well, the answer lies in the fact that in this country alone, we've lost 14 million acres of prime farmland in the past 25 years to development. So increased productivity, soil health is going to be a critical component to that increased productivity in the future.
Yeah, I can sure see that. Alexander, you know, let's talk about soil. You know, I'm wondering, unless you are lucky enough, and if you're a person of a certain age who went to the University of Wisconsin, you might have been fortunate enough to take in a course from Professor Francis Hohl, who was one of the great professors on this campus, and he taught a class in soils. And I don't know if you ever had that class, but
It was actually a little before my time.
Yeah, it was before your time. You're too young for that. But the rest of us, though, can certainly remember a guy who used to bring his violin to class, and he'd say, this is what Anago silt loam sounds like, and this is what sandy soil sounds like. And he was a wonderful professor. And so if you took his class, you learned really what is soil. And you didn't, but you know what is soil. What is soil?
I do. Well, I suppose one of the first things I'd like to say is that soil is made up of many things, but one thing it is not is dirt. I consider dirt a four-letter word, actually. So. But because dirt is really what gets on your clothes. Yeah. It gets under your fingernails, and it's something to wash off and get rid of. But soil is really another story. And while it might look similar to dirt, there's actually a pretty big difference.
Yeah, and how does soil come to be?
Well, Larry, I can tell your listeners that soil is the outmost layer of the Earth's crust and is really considered the skin of the Earth. And it's really a complex mix of ingredients, which really includes four main components, and that's organic matter, water, air, and minerals. And it's really made up of life. Soils are alive.
Yeah, and it's actually Jay in Holman has a question relating or comment relating to this, and I'm just going to go to Jay right now because I think it's perfect. Jay, hi, thanks for calling.
Hello, Larry. Thank you for having me. I had Jim Love in the soils department in the late 60s myself, and he was equally impressive. And if I recall correctly, what he taught me was that most of the nutrients and microorganisms in the soil are in the top 12 to 18 inches, and once you get down much deeper, they're deprived of oxygen and there's much less life in them, and certainly less organic matter. So my question is that in construction sites these days, you know, you can drive down the interstate and see these piles of, quote, black earth that are, you know, sitting there 30 feet high with a bulldozer sitting on top of it. And my question is how long can that stuff stay there before all of it is starved of oxygen, damaged, and essentially does become black dirt because it's been starved of nutrients and oxygen and stuff?
Well, that's Jimmy Bramma. Maybe you can talk about it. First, I think Jay is correct, isn't he? Most nutrients are in the top, foot or so?
Yeah, that's actually a great example. And when I took soils courses way back in college, maybe not quite as far as you all are talking about, but when I took soils courses, one of the analogies the soil professor gave us was, and Alex talked about this, is the skin of the crust of the earth. And he said he held up an apple, he cut an apple, and he said, look at the skin of this apple in relation to the rest of the mass of this apple. He said the fragility of our soil is actually much thinner than the skin of the apple in relation to the rest of the apple. So it's a tremendously fragile piece of our culture, our living culture that we depend on. So in response to the caller's question, having soil out there on the side of the interstate, it is beginning to lose some of the critical properties that we look for when we talk about healthy soil. And those properties are, you know, combined with the chemical, the physical, the biological nature. And so if there's not a balance between each of those properties, then it begins to break down. And life, as Alex was talking about earlier, life begins to be removed from that soil. And it does become dirt, which I was told was soil out of place.
There we go.
And it really is a finite resource, too, Larry. Just kind of going on that apple story. The one that I heard was very similar in class. If you cut up an apple when you're getting ready to eat it, 25% of that apple, on that first bite can really be considered the dry land that's available on Earth, while 75% of it, the main part of the apple, is water. So if you look at the apple and think of it as Earth, it's covered by water. Now, if you continue to cut that down, 25% of the land, if you cut that in half, is too dry, too cold or too hot to sustain crops, and then you cut that one in half again, it's too rocky, too steep, too shallow, and then so you're really talking about the skin of the apple, of a very small piece of that, of what we're really talking about.
Yeah.
I'm not on any longer, am I?
Yeah, yes you are, Jay.
Oh, okay. So if you can kind of fine-tune my question a little bit, is how deep is that outside 12 or 18 inches going to be before everything inside of that is diminished and made useless, and how long does it take for that inner core of those big mountains to become worthless and for most of the nutrients and microorganisms to die?
Go ahead, Jimmy.
This is, and it depends on a variety of factors. It depends on the parent material. We talk about how soil is made, and it's a weathering process from rock, basically. And we talk about it being a finite resource. It is renewable, but the caution I would caveat that with is it takes many, many, many years for soil to rebuild itself. And depending on your religion, your theories, your philosophies, your education, your science prescriptions, we're talking tens of thousands of years versus billions of years. So it depends primarily on each individual site location, the materials that make up that soil, what condition that soil was in when it was excavated, and what conditions that soil happens to be placed into once it's displaced and put out on the side of the highway. In reality, most soils, most silt loams that are fairly good soils, they will lose properties very quickly without the rejuvenation of additional input in microbial life in there. Set out as a pile on the side of the interstate, it would be within months, and I'm talking 18 to 20 months.
Oh,
I appreciate you. You've reinforced what I've been saying for a long time.
All right. Thanks, Jay.
Thank you.
And you're right about Jim Love. He's a great lecturer as well. and a really good guy. Jim Love taught soils science at the UW-Madison as well. Well, what about you? Are you conscious of your soil's health? Have you ever had your soil tested? What'd you find? Love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And as a matter of fact, if you got a kind of a neat soil picture, photograph, you can post that up on the Facebook page as well. That would be great to have and great for us to look at. Again, 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, talking today with Alexander Barton, who's Director of Business Development for the Agronomic Science Foundation and for the Alliance of Crop, Soil, and Environmental Science Societies. And Jimmy Bramble, is a state conservationist with the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. Both our guests here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network as we talk with our two guests today, Alexander Barton and Jimmy Bramblett, about healthy soil. And we're going to continue that discussion later on, about 11:45 today. We'll be talking about how to create better soil through composting and how to put worms to work to make your soil better. So that's coming up at about 11:45. Right now, though, healthy soil, our topic with Alexander Barton and Jimmy Bramblett. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Jimmy, I'll start with you. This question about the Natural Resources Conservation Service, the department. You're a state conservationist. What's your role out there?
Well, the Natural Resources Conservation Service is charged by Congress with working with private landowners across the country. We have offices that have responsibilities for every county in the country. And when you think about the United States and the amount of public land versus private land, 73% of the land in this country is privately owned.
Yeah.
So our agency really works with these private landowners and helping them be good stewards of the land to not only do good soil conservation practices, but water quality practices, wildlife habitat practices, everything natural resource management-wise. We basically work with landowners on a voluntary basis.
Well, and we have, by the way, up on our Facebook page, on my Facebook page, we do have a link to one of your websites, at least, the Natural Resources Conservation Service site. So if people, part of your role is to just get out there and talk to people and sometimes view their properties, I assume.
That's exactly right. We have district conservationists that, as I was saying, cover every county.
Yeah.
And basically, we are fortunate in that Congress has recognized there's a need for a public investment because there are many benefits not only on private lands but offside of those private lands that we all enjoy. For example, when we work with farmers to do soil conservation practices, what we're doing is reducing the amount of nutrients, pollutants, sediment that actually gets into the waterways.
Yeah.
And in turn, for what does that mean for you and me? That means that our water bill is less because the water treatment plants don't have to treat water as much to get it to the drinking water quality we all enjoy.
Yeah. And then we look at all the professionals that are involved with our soils in one way or another, Alexander, and you're representing a lot of those folks, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's right. AXIS, the Alliance of Crop, Soil, and Environmental Science Society, is actually headquartered here in Madison, represents over 6,000 soil scientists who are professionals working in the field with crop production, environmental quality, as Jimmy mentioned, ecosystem sustainability. And this is really a great bunch of people. They work with the earth. They care about the earth. They provide data and statistics that can be used by policymakers who can then use that information and create a level playing field of rules. And so it's just a very exciting group to work with.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. I know a lot of those folks, and there's some really good people out there, and it's got to be rewarding to work with them. James in Bayfield County has a question for you guys. James, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
My question is, biochar, agricultural charcoal, is that on you guys' radar yet?
So the biochar, as a soil amendment, is one of the things that can improve soil health. When we're talking about soil health, as I mentioned earlier, we're talking about the biological, physical, and the chemical properties. And biochar also helps increase that structural component. We're looking for pore space that will allow for that oxygen that Alexander talked about a little bit earlier in the show, as well as free up the cycling of nutrients, allow the microorganisms to move freely and cycle water and regulate water. So NRCS is actually initiating a soil health initiative, we're calling it. And over the next couple of years, you're actually going to hear a lot more information come out of the Natural Resources Conservation Service about our soil health initiative. That initiative will train every one of our employees across the country, including our secretaries, our mail clerks, our drivers, to understand what soil health is. And in collaboration with other entities like Alexander's and the Cooperative Extension Service, the information that we develop from a technical and scientific basis will be shared with you locally at your own house.
That is very cool. That is very cool. Thank you very much. You mentioned soils, soil types, and I'll go back to Francis Hole just once more because he and his class, he lobbied long and hard to get Antigo silk loam named the Wisconsin, the state soil of Wisconsin. And what's so good about Antigo silk loam?
Well, Antigo silk loam is has a mix of properties that make it already advantageous for some of the soil's initial major functions we think of, and that is growing plants. That's one of the main things that we all typically think in terms of soil. We get our food from the soil.
Yeah.
But the relative productivity of Antigo silk loam is much higher than it is for most other soils in other states. I'm originally from Georgia, and the Georgia state soil is a state soil we call Tifton, and it is a highly sandy soil, so the productive capacity is not near as high as the Antigo silt loam, and the properties of this Antigo silt loam, the ability for it to hold water, the ability for it to host these living organisms that Alexander talked about, the ability for it to do all of this without supplemental irrigation or supplemental synthetic fertilizers is extremely remarkable.
Yeah.
And Jimmy, that's really the trick. You just mentioned it because healthy soil contains life.
Yeah.
And the soil in Wisconsin sustains the life of the microbes such as bacteria, fungus, includes mushrooms, earthworms, as you mentioned before, insects, and even other soil animals like prairie dogs and gophers. It's really a complex mix of these things interacting with each other that defines it.
Yeah. And you mentioned, Jimmy mentioned sand, and Andy in Jefferson has a question I think that relates to sand. Andy, are you there?
Yes, I am. Maybe you've kind of answered this with the last one, but I'm trying to improve the health of my raised beds, and I was wondering if adding some sand to them, they're mostly compost, and so I was just wondering, since I have this sand, mixing the sand with inside the raised bed, if that would improve the overall soil conditions.
What do you think, Jimmy?
I think, the first thing you want to do is make sure you do a soil test and have a good handle on what it is you're actually working with. It sounds like if you have raised beds and you have a lot of organic matter in there, you're well on your way. When we talked earlier about the parent material or the weathering, and Alexander talked about the properties of soil, it is that other part of that came from rock that kind of helps build that structure that we need in order to have all the beneficial qualities that we're talking about. So if not knowing or seeing your particular soil, if sand kind of moves you back on that continuum toward that parent-type material, then that would be advantageous.
One of the nice things I think about soil testing is that you can say, okay, this soil is from my garden, I'm going to be raising vegetables here. Can you tell me what I'm, and you'll get back a report then that's specific to your, to what you're planning to raise and grow, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And if you by chance don't know how to get that done, you can take a sample of the soil in the area that you're interested in and put it in something as simple as a mason jar. Take it down to your local county extension agent, and they'll send it to the University of Wisconsin's soil test lab that will in turn provide you with a report of the nutrient content, organic matter, which will give you insight into some of the ideas we're talking about related to healthy soil today.
Yeah.
And, Larry, I'm really happy we're having this discussion today because that's what it's going to take. It's gonna, if we're going to feed over 9 billion people and increasing, we're going to need to have the cooperation from the policymakers in D.C., from the scientists providing the data, to the farmers trying the new methods, both organic and non-organic farming methods. We need to have them working together and creating a discussion, as well as the people at home who are interested in growing their own food, taking more of an interest in nature, in soil, and that's what it's really going to take.
Yeah, absolutely. Andy, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Bob in Horicon, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I've got a question. In visiting certain islands in the Caribbean, a lot of these are volcanic islands.
Yep.
And in all these cases, they say the soil on volcanic islands is just the best there is. And I was just wondering, is that from the volcanic ash rather than necessarily lava and stuff? And how long does it take for that to become good soil?
So we were talking earlier about the parent material and the weathering process associated with the soils that we see and we work with all around us. And if you think about the types of rocks that become the initial formation of soils, you're basically looking at sedimentary igneous and metamorphic type rocks. And basically what you're talking about is the parent material coming from the lava versus what's coming from the ashes. Those are two totally different components of that soil. Most of the base there from a longer term is going to be the lava. The shorter term overlay is going to be from the ash. But either one of those constituents provide good building blocks for rich soil because of that parent material, the types of chemicals that are associated with that rock, and the ability for that those chemicals to allow the life in the soil to interact back and forth to do the things we're talking about.
Yeah.
And as Jimmy mentioned, a lot of the minerals in soil come from the bedrock, such as calcium or potassium or magnesium, and those are often the ones that you'll find listed on the side of your daily vitamin. So plants need those nutrients. Plants need those minerals as well. And so when you have those in the soil, as you mentioned, it does make for a rich and fertile soil.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are some I spent a lot of time in the Caribbean myself. I taught at the University of the West Indies for a year and worked on, I worked in Dominica and Grenada and Montserrat and St. Vincent and St. Kitts and Nevis. And some of those, Grenada, some of those islands had, talking about loss, had, were losing by erosion 18 to 20 tons of topsoil per acre per year, which is, for the most part, I don't think we lose that much here, but we certainly are. Certainly have our problems. It was not nearly as bad, I don't think, Alexander.
Well, one of the things that I saw recently when I went on my honeymoon to Hawaii was the island is really doing battle with the elements from the moment it rises out of the ocean.
Yeah.
The wind, the sun, the water, it's all constantly eroding it, as well as the sea, the ocean waves.
Yeah.
And then another thing associated in there, you mentioned 18 tons. One of the things that we work with private landowners to do is identify what their soil loss tolerance is. And that depends on a variety of factors, including what type of tillage techniques are taking place, what the slope of that soil happens to be residing on, what kind of vegetation happens to be there. Just to give you some insight, in Wisconsin, on pastures, we're looking at somewhere below 3 tons per acre.
Yeah.
By comparison to the 18 tons per acre you were talking about in the Caribbean.
And that's that is good news for sure. I think Art Peterson, an old soil scientist, told me that a ton of soil was about what you'd find if you filled your bathtub. And I'm not sure if that's correct. But I'm not sure if that's right. But that's probably about right. You think about it, depending on the size of your bathtub.
And again, it depends. Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, most conservative estimates will put about 90 pounds per cubic feet. So you might have to have a pretty good sized bathtub in order to get a ton.
To get a ton in there? Okay. Oh, Bob, I hope we answered your question.
Yes, and you kind of... when you guys are talking about water runoff too, I've noticed that a lot of the islands that have the most problems with uncontrolled water runoff also have problems with all the coral dying in the area.
Yeah, so. and that would definitely have an impact, wouldn't it, Jimmy?
That's exactly right. And if you think about, we've made a lot of progress since 1935. When you think back to the old Dust Bowl days. And a lot of the activities that we pursue as an agency and the people with whom we work have done a fantastic job of helping to educate the public of soil conservation practices, water conservation practices, water quality conservation practices, etc. But to bring this back home a little bit, if you just remember back to last summer in this part of the world and the drought that we had here, that drought was similar to the drought of the Dust Bowl days, but we didn't see those mounds and clouds of dark smoke of soil moving from one state to another like we did back in the 1930s.
Yeah. Thanks again, Bob. Appreciate it very much. I want to turn to Nancy in East Troy next. Nancy, hello. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to know, what is the effect of hardwood mulch after years of mulching on a garden bed? Should you be adding something to it then, or
so you've
not
been,
be mulching that often?
So you put wood chips?
Yes, hardwood mulch.
Yeah, okay.
Well, and Larry, you mentioned that that following this segment, you'll be talking a little more in detail about some of these
yes.
specific activities. From our perspective, I think what we would be probably wise to say at this point, not knowing the specifics of the soil, we would be at a loss to advise any more recommendation. I will always go back to, and this is one of the nice things about soil health, if we can continue to get in our mind, is there's three basic concepts. It's got to have good physical properties. Of course, what that means is having good structure
yep.
and a little bit of a balance, good pore space. It's got to have good chemical properties. What that means is not having too many chemicals that can kill the microbes and the other organisms in the soil. It's got to have balanced pH, and it's got to have good biological properties. And what that means is organic matter. So when you're talking about wood chips, that's part of that biological component
yeah.
there, along with all the other microbes. And so any imbalance of one over the other begins to move us in the direction of some kind of unhealthy soil.
Yeah.
And Larry, that's what I really find so interesting about soils is how different they are. They all come from parent material. So if you think of it like each other, we all have different parents, and we all look a little different, act a little different. The soils are the same. And one way to see that is through a soil monolith or a soil profile. If you're ever driving down the road and you see a crosscut of a soil, you'll understand what I'm talking about. But the NRCS actually has an impressive display of every state's soil in a soil monolith, and it's currently at the Bell Museum in Minneapolis, Minnesota. It's called Dig It, and it's a specific soils exhibit. And it's going to be there
very
until
cool.
the end of July, and that's a great place to go see these monoliths.
Very, very cool. Nancy, I thank you very much. Thanks for calling, and stay listening because we're going to be talking a whole lot more about mulch.
Thank you. I think a test is in order.
Ah, yeah. Well, you know that. You get all that wood on there, and they start the microbes, they start working on that, but they tie up all the nitrogen in the soil, and you're going to have... You need to almost think about other fertilizing opportunities, which we'll probably get to here at one point or another. Craig in Hamburg, it's your turn. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering, I am a farmer, and our land is we rotationally graze cows on it and trying to improve it that way. But I'm reading, I read Acres USA, journals like that quite a bit, and one of the things that they're talking quite a bit about now is the bacteria. I think it's called mycorrhizae bacteria. That kind of, and that, you know, different companies are wanting to sell you the inoculant, you know, to try to put on your soil. What do you think about that,
Jimmy? Go ahead and comment.
Well, first, let me give you distant praise and accolades for doing rotational grazing on your with your cows out there. That's one of the practices that we try to encourage those who have cows to do. It provides a whole host of benefits well beyond the soil. But in answer to your specific question about commercial bacteria, I would again go back to the earlier comments we made about making sure you have your soil tested. And once you have your soil tested, you'll have an idea about what kind of balance between these physical, chemical, and biological properties that you have there. In this particular case, if you're finding that your organic matter is low, which is probably not going to be the case for too many Wisconsin soils, but if you're finding that your organic matter is low, then you might want to introduce a little more organic matter, and along with that will come some of these bacteria, and to help hasten the process, something commercially might be advantageous. But again, that's a site-specific answer.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good point, Jimmy. Actually, there was an article in the New York Times last week, which I felt did a good job explaining the biodiversity of soil. The author, Jim Robbins, mentioned that in just one teaspoon of healthy soil, there are billions of microbes, which could hold the cure for many diseases. Because when these microbes compete with each other, they produce antibiotics as a defense. And so these antibiotics and the biodiversity needs to be studied and explored further.
Yeah, absolutely. Craig, thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. And we have an open line or two. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Thomas in Manitowoc, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, this is a great program, as they all are, Larry. But what I wanted to ask is, as we currently use our chemically induced agriculture now with all the fertilizers to feed a growing population, how large is the world's supply of potash and phosphorus going to last as we currently use it? You were talking about increasing our food production, but as our soils become more exhausted as we currently use them, if we run out of additives, the soils are going to be in really bad shape for a long time before, mm-hmm. before they can be corrected properly.
Interesting question.
Yeah, that's actually a great observation. And it brings up a good point, and that is a lot of people think in terms of soil health as the same thing as soil fertility. But in reality, they're two different animals. Soil fertility basically go almost exactly to the type of question that your caller just came in with, and that is what kind of chemical component of this three-legged stool we're talking about, what kind of chemical component we have here that can help support the productivity of plants. But the nice thing about soil health and healthy soil is when you have these properties in balance with each other, they actually are cycling the water, they're cycling the nutrients. And then, as Alexander said earlier, when you get the plant diversity on there, then you're actually recycling nutrients, natural nutrients that are already there without the need to have so many synthetic fertilizers added to the system.
Yeah.
And that just kind of goes back to the discussion, because there's all kinds of tools that, like that can be used to produce food. And that includes the responsible use of fertilizers as one of them. It includes certain agrochemicals. It includes organic farming. It includes non-organic farming. The trick is we need to use all of them if we're going to be expected to meet the food demands of the future.
I'm always amazed at what farmers have got, have the kinds of tools that they have at their disposal. Now I had a friend who's, you know, when he's planting, he's the machinery or whatever, the GPS and all, everything that he's doing is reading his soil and providing less or more of materials depending on the health of the soil or the fertility of the soil.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We call it precision agriculture. And even with precision agriculture, we still may be over-applying in a lot of farms some of the synthetics. If you think about, as a side note, you think about the Lower Fox watershed, which drains into Green Bay. The city of Green Bay is actually having to look at a multi-$100 million waste treatment plant upgrade. What they're realizing is, hey, an ounce of prevention is actually worth a pound of cure.
Yeah.
And they've come to us and the Great Lakes Commission and said, you know, if we can do more of these soil health practices on the landscape, we feel like there will be a reduction in the amount of nutrients getting into the waterway. We will be able to help mitigate the increase in the construction cost associated with that water treatment plant upgrade. So even with precision agriculture, we would still advocate for a lot of these soil health techniques and practices that we're talking about here today.
Yeah, that's really great. And Thomas, again, I want to thank you for joining us as well. Well, what should we leave our listeners with today, Jimmy? If you're going to leave our listeners with something, with a word, or what would it be?
I think that this is actually a good start. Some of the things we're talking about for the Natural Resources Conservation Service in some ways are actually a rebirth of the agency's origination back in the Dust Bowl days. But at that day and time, we really only talked about soil erosion.
Yeah.
By going back, as we call it, to our basic principles of soil health and adding in these other concepts, This is something that can be practiced by everybody that is in our listening audience, whether you're a large-scale farmer who's doing thousands and thousands of acres or whether you are a gardener who is trying to do a raised plot. Yeah, these soil health concepts and principles apply across the board.
Yeah. And Alexander?
And Larry, this is something that really applies to all of the listeners because almost everything we need can be traced back to healthy soil, and it's not just food. For instance, the shirt I'm wearing is made from cotton that grew in soil. The wooden pencil that I'm holding is made from cedar trees, you know, harvested from well-drained soil. The football that I used to punt for the Badgers was made from leather that came from cows who grazed on Wisconsin prairies. The computer chip in the cell phone contains silicon, processed from a particle of soil. And the water that we're drinking right now is purified by passing through soil. So this is really an issue that affects all of us, and we're all going to need to be brought to the table to have this discussion.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it very much. And frankly, for in both of your cases, for more information, go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We've got links there to all of the things we've been talking about today. And there's a lot of good, by the way, there is a lot of good, useful information. For example, at the USDA's Conservation Service, there's a lot of tips and useful information right there. Yeah. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure being here.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Alexander Barton is Director of Business Development for the Agronomic Science Foundation and for the Alliance of Crop, Soil, and Environmental Science Societies. Jimmy Bramblett is State Conservationist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Natural Resources Conservation Service. Great to have them along. Great conversation. I hope you have a little more appreciation for soil after our little conversation here. Coming up next, we're going to talk about how each of us, you and I, can create better soil through composting and how to put worms to work. I hope you'll stay with us right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.